From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's Thanksgiving. For many, a day of giving thanks, seeing family and friends, feasting. Although this year you can throw in Zoom calls and doorstep dinner drop-offs, it's a day muted by the pandemic. But for many Native Americans, it's long been a day of mourning. Mourning ancestors lost to massacres and European-born illnesses. And today, Native Americans are among the hardest hit by COVID-19. They're more than twice as likely to be infected compared with white people and more likely to die from COVID, according to the CDC. The Navajo Nation in Arizona is under a stay-at-home order, and cases have shot up in the Great Plains, including the Dakotas. The Indian Health Service Federal Agency reported a 25% positivity rate among Native Americans there. So let's go to the Great Plains. Geraldine Church is president and CEO of the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board. She's in Rapid City, South Dakota. And Geraldine, I will not say happy Thanksgiving to you because that is not appropriate, but it's a sad day in your community anyway this year. What are you seeing?
Well, what we see here is a lot of families losing those who they love most. And especially in the last few weeks, we've seen just an incredible surge despite the many efforts that our tribes have made to keep our population safe. You know, we're in states where the state leadership have not taken the virus serious.
Well, let's be more forthright here. The governor of North Dakota only recently instituted mask wearing. The governor of South Dakota has yet to do that. She's been saying that her people are free. We saw the motorcycle rally in Sturgis, South Dakota, which was a super spreader of the disease. How does it work for the Native Americans in the Great Plains? Do they live and work together, or are they all interacting with the general population?
Both. So on the reservation, there's a little bit more ability for our tribal leaders to close the borders and institute curfews. But in the urban areas where we are, there's no way to separate. So a lot of the service jobs, it's our population that are filling those roles. It's our population that was cleaning the rooms for the people that were attending the rally and serving the food, because they have to bring home, you know, the paycheck. And so right after the rally, we saw a significant jump in infections and death rate. But we also saw something else, too, that was encouraging. While our governor was in conflict with some of our tribal leaders about the measures they were putting in place to close their borders, we saw that our numbers, despite our anticipation that they would be much higher, were actually consistent with the percentage of infection rate of American Indians in South Dakota. We saw those numbers go from 25% down to about 13% because of the measures that the tribal leaders put in place on the reservations.
Because you were wearing masks.
Wearing masks. We were telling people not to attend the rally. We were telling people to stay home. And what we saw was our people taking this virus so much more serious than the general population. And what we saw was our tribal leadership taking so much more responsibility to keep our people safe than our own governor was.
Does any of that, do you think, have to do with a passed-down memory of smallpox, for instance?
Oh, absolutely. There's a history of our people being disproportionately impacted by a multitude of infectious diseases, smallpox, tuberculosis, and even as recently as H1N1, my own mother was impacted by tuberculosis as a small child. She understood what was at stake and at no time ever for a moment thought that this was a hoax. They understood that when we are told that a disease is coming, that we need to take measures to stay safe.
Do you have family that's been impacted? Do you have family that's been sick?
Absolutely. On both sides of my family, there was an article recently written about my nephew who died in prison in Missouri. He wrote 17 letters asking if he could come home because he was on dialysis. And he didn't get to come home. He got COVID and he passed away. On my dad's side, he recently lost his cousin who was a Vietnam veteran, and then a number of extended relatives that have gotten sick or have passed away, and most of that has been in recent weeks.
Well, we're so sorry, and we wish you and your community health and luck in getting on the other side of this, although you also have science, which
yes.
is the best thing you can have. Geraldine Church, President and CEO of the Great Plains Tribal Leaders Health Board there in the Dakotas, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to Midland, Michigan now, where the annual Trot on the Tridge, raising money for food banks, was canceled today. So was the Granville, Ohio Turkey Trot for Hungry Families. Chillicothe, Ohio's Larry Cox Turkey Trot, a fundraiser for Crime Stoppers, also canceled. Thousands of charity runs, all fundraising galas, have been shut down. So what has COVID-19 meant for the giving season? Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Hi, Stacey.
Hello. Great to be with you.
Well, and we're reading that there were spikes when people gave their stimulus checks to charities early on in the pandemic, and also many affluent people weren't affected by the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. So they were giving. But on the other hand, the American Cancer Society is looking at a $200 million shortfall. How would you characterize the charitable world right now?
It's very uneven. There is a lot of giving. So overall, charities have had a spike in giving from those very wealthy people, but demand is increasing so much that they're not able to keep up with all of the people who are requesting aid. And in a lot of cases, charities say, you know, people who come to food banks, for example, they might have been donors in the past, but now they're in desperate need. What nonprofits are really worried about is what comes next, especially because we haven't seen a stimulus package yet.
Yeah, well, stay with food banks for a second. They're seeing a 60% increase in demand this year. We've seen the photographs of, you know, people in their cars because of COVID. The line might be, you know, a couple miles long. Housing, community centers, you know, these are sort of smaller nonprofits. These are groups that are going to continue to need money, not just for today.
Precisely. The needs have been severe all year long, and they're only going to grow worse as people are jobless and need help. So that's just in the social services area. But think about other things like mental health, those kinds of groups that maybe aren't the first kind of thing you think about. But as people are socially isolated, those organizations need help. Domestic violence is up. All kinds of organizations are seeing increases in demand, and they're struggling to raise money themselves.
Well, and how do we do this? Because we know people are holding virtual events to replace galas. The virtual events have gotten mixed results. People are Zoomed out. They were a novelty in the beginning, not so much now. And someone you interviewed said there's no substitute for being with people at events. You can sidle up to somebody, you know, talk to them about their donation. Now you really can have those personal moments. So what are nonprofits doing to make the virtual events better and to make them go a little further?
Yeah, it's a real struggle to translate that into online work. But some nonprofits are making it happen. Some groups, for example, are leading tours to other parts of the world. For example, a conservation charity might have virtual safaris. Groups that are raising money for Israel are taking people on virtual trips. And those things are so popular because we all want a chance to feel like we're getting out of our homes, that now there are waiting lists for those kinds of things. So some groups are finding that they're able to attract plenty of interest. And then others say that it's just not raising the same kind of thing that a gala would do. So some people who used to go to galas and really miss seeing their friends, they're just reaching out to other donors and saying, you know, we ought to give, even if we're not giving in the same way and we don't get to see each other. And that's a responsibility that we can all take upon ourselves. Reach out to 10 friends and say, you know, this is a group I care about. We could all try to make a gift.
Oh, fascinating. So nonprofits are enlisting the wealthy who are givers to reach out to others. Stacey, as we approach this season of giving, we've got Giving Tuesday coming up. How do you know that a charity is legit?
If you want to do some online research, there are sites like Candid where you can go check out a group, make sure it's reliable. You can check with your state attorney general, often has a list to warn you what's a scam. But we shouldn't let concern about fraud get in the way. There are so many groups that are in need that we've all cared about.
And you say you can also donate a skill if you don't have cash. What about giving things? Is there a way to do that better?
Giving things is not as helpful as giving cash. So if you have the option, if you have spare cash, that's a great thing to do. Certainly people are able to give clothing or food or other kinds of things.
Diapers.
Exactly. You can do those things safely. And in a lot of neighborhoods, there are groups that are springing up called mutual aid societies, really small local grassroots efforts where communities come together. So if you just Google that kind of thing, you can find a way to give. But it's important for people to think about that what charities use your money for is to efficiently distribute food and other kinds of things. So that's why we emphasize that idea of giving cash. It's a much more efficient thing than giving things that they have to then find a way to distribute. And especially in this pandemic time, it's just not healthy.
Well, great tips. Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Thank you so much and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. And thank you for calling attention to the needs of the nonprofits. It's really important.
Argentinian composer Osvaldo Galahad's long-awaited piece, Falling Out of Time, was just released. We were in his home in an old converted church in Brookline, Massachusetts in 2019 when it was being crafted.
Let's explore. Show me what you have.
Osvaldo is meeting with some members of the Silk Road Ensemble to work through a piece they've been workshopping since 2017. This is Osvaldo's musical interpretation of Israeli author David Grossman's soul-piercing 2014 novel, Falling Out of Time, about a couple grieving the death of a child. The father, made crazy by his sadness, he says he must walk to where the child is. The mother knows that's impossible. She watches from a belfry as he walks in circles around the town. Members of the community who've lost children join him, a pilgrimage to nowhere. You happen to live in a church that's been converted to.
Yeah.
Does that add to this? Because it feels sacred.
I think there are 100 years of people having prayed here. Those vibrations stay.
Utan, what does it sound like when you say something into the microphone?
Ba.
It's too loud.
Ba.
That's Silk Road's Jeremy Flower working on computerized feedback of Wu Tang, who sings largely in Hebrew the part of the father.
I mean, we were going to try for the very, very first time one of the crazier numbers. Wu Tang, do you want to just try it? The father is already in the hills around the town, and he plays this almost like a children's game. So the father is so crazy at that time that he thinks, okay, as long as I don't blink, I can empty my body and my son can come in. He can use my body as a house and he can live the life that he didn't live.
Bo. Bo.
And he says, come. He's bo, bo, bo. Come, son, come and live for me and love and betray and be betrayed and be brave and touch a woman and touch the head of a newborn baby unborn to you. And then he says, come, my eyelids are trembling. And then he says, no, don't come, because I don't want you to see with my own eyes what happened to you. And that's how it ends, the first half. That's only one part. One number. But we'll see. We are trying to find it. Biela will be the wife in the piece.
Biela is Biela da Costa, the acclaimed Venezuelan singer. As the wife, she grieves the loss of her son and her walking husband.
It's a different kind of pain. And we are trying to figure it out. How will she sing all those? There is a lot of melismas, which means like wailing music, right? And we are trying to find the sound for it. She's been getting music day by day. And anyways, but do you want to try some?
Bueno, Melissa, es que no lo tengo listo.
Just me on the piano?
Okay.
This is, to me, the most important moment of the piece. What happens is there is this tremendous tension between the husband and the wife, where the husband says, come with me. And she says, no, I would go with you to the end of the world, but I cannot go there because there doesn't exist. And I barely, I beg you, don't go. Don't get out of the circle of light. Don't come back to me, come back to us. And at the same time that the husband is singing, "You were right, wife, there is no there." The wife will say, "Go now, go now." She encourages him. She says, "Go now, be like him. There will be peace for you and for him. Do you want to, let's go there, go now. Go now, eh?"
Run from this depth of emotion. I understand you got a few pages in the book and you said, "I have to do it."
Yeah, and of course, once I actually did start doing it, I wanted to run away, but it was too late. But what? How can this be compared to the people that have lived through this? And I personally know, I'm dedicating the piece to 7 couples that I know who lost children, and this is incredible. I mean, this one thing that David made me aware of is that there is not in Hebrew and not in English and not in Spanish, not a one word that describes this. You know, you cannot say widow, widower, orphan. This, you have to say what? Bereaved parent. It's, you know, even language fears.
So where language fails, music steps in.
This is like almost like an anti-requiem, right? I think a requiem implies acceptance. This father that walks, that keeps walking, is refusal to accept. This illusion that as long as I'm walking, I'm in motion, this particular boy is alive. It's a limping walk, and that took me a while to figure out. Musically speaking, it's very simple. That, that, that. That's a regular walk. I do 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Do you mind if
no,
we
find it?
So it's really...
While you're bringing this up on the computer, I have to say that you're feeling your music physically.
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's what I always try to tell my students, that they teach you a lot about the pitch and the rhythms, right? But the music that I feel I came to the world to do comes from something that comes before music. Here will come the walk. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's it. Now Wu-Tang will come with the voice.
We huddle around computers, playing back demos, picturing a father limping in circles.
Here is just, you know, 1 foot lightly lifts from the earth, the other, and we are all walking together and nobody knows who is carrying whom.
How do you feel about your piece, Osvaldo Golahov?
I feel that I got this one.
You exactly. Know?
I mean, in every piece where I got it, I felt it. And where I didn't get it, I also knew that I didn't get it, you know?
You don't feel it.
There is not that thing in my sternum or in my stomach, however, but I know when, and here, what I wanted to find, I found.
1 week later, Osvaldo Golahov and the full 13-member Silk Road Ensemble, musicians from around the world, premiere Falling Out of Time at College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, where Osvaldo is a professor. Osvaldo tells me that years before David Grossman's book, he met a Jewish man in Israel named Ishtok Frankenthal, who lost a child in the conflicts there, and brought together Israelis and Palestinians who'd lost children.
And he told me the story of a man who had lost his son, and he would sleep on the grave of his son. Yitzhak decided that what he would do was to accompany this man, to just sleep with him until the man was able to leave the cemetery and go back to his home. And so that stayed with me. This idea of the father that loses a child and says, "I have to go there." I also, with my music, have to go there.
Leah Hager-Cohen writes sort of a synopsis of the piece, and she pointed out, like the man Yitzhak Frankenthal, who goes to sit with the grieving father, like the townspeople who join the father and walk in circles, that you do the same thing. You accompany Grossman. And in turn, you reach out to the Silk Road Ensemble. They join this mm-hmm. group. You're all doing all that we... There's the only thing you can do when somebody's had this loss is accompany them.
Right, right. That's what community is. And just be there. You don't have to say anything. But perhaps the only way of saying, please stay alive, you know. Near the end, after the realization that it is impossible to go, quote-unquote, there, to touch again what is gone, the voice of a boy appears, and the boy sings a lullaby to his parents. The boy sings, there is breath inside the pain. The child is singing to his own parents. I cannot think of anything more more terrifying in a way and more beautiful.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
Just days ago, AstraZeneca and Oxford University announced that their coronavirus vaccine worked in the majority of people who received it in trials. But now the company's admitted an error, which is raising lots of questions about its data. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, happy Thanksgiving to you.
And to you.
Yeah, thanks for taking some time with us. So to give some context here, Moderna and Pfizer announced great results with their vaccine. They still seem on course. This is AstraZeneca, which acknowledged a mistake in the vaccine dosage received by some study participants. Explain.
So there was one group of 2,741 participants. Remember, you need a lot of participants to make this work. Right. They received a lower dose of the vaccine. It was a half a dose and then a full dose a month later. Now, all of those subjects, all of the 2,700 subjects who got this, were under the age of 55. So they were considered the lowest risk group in the trial. And the trial showed 90% efficacy for them, which was really good. The 8,895 participants who received the full dose showed 62% efficacy. Now, all of it's pretty good because the FDA standard is 50% efficacy. But we've since heard from Pfizer and we've heard from Moderna about 90% plus efficacy. So we don't really know what the answer is. When you combine this mathematically, you get an average of about 70% efficacy. But that may not actually be true because you actually just have to have a trial that's done properly. But that's what the problem is, that it does appear that in the general population, the efficacy is substantially lower than what we originally thought it would be.
Well, there's that. And, you know, half a dose, like, do they have any idea why that's working?
Well, you know, this is the problem with vaccines. You got to cover a lot of things. You got to figure out who your sample group is, what the risk otherwise would have been, and how much dosage you want to give. Because while they have Most of these are reported to have very few side effects. They always have some side effects, and we don't have long-term studies where we can say what happens a year down the road, 5 years down the road. So companies generally want to give you the lowest dose possible initially for a vaccine, the lowest dose that's effective. So that's the problem. If you have a vaccine now with AstraZeneca that's at about 70%, and then you've got two other vaccines that are 95%, creates all sorts of logistical problems. Which one are you going to take? Right. Which one can you get? Why would you take this one if you could get the other ones? And part of the problem is you can't get the other ones as easily. This one was going to be the easiest to be able to distribute.
Right. Well, we only have a minute here, but you're the business guy. And, you know, Mark, the markets are watching this. And the American healthcare and biotech investment firm, SVB Leerink, said the AstraZeneca trial didn't follow some FDA rules. Because of that, it would never be licensed in the U.S. Putting that aside, because we just don't know really, this is something we haven't really figured out what it is yet. But is this one of the problems of, you know, we're doing this all by press release and not regulatory bodies?
Yes. It's a huge problem, and we will deal with this, I think, after this coronavirus is over. But fundamentally, you're supposed to get your drug information from peer-reviewed journals and from regulatory bodies. And we're getting these from press releases. And the other thing that's happening, Robin, is after all of these things, the stocks go up, and a lot of insiders sell the stock on that thing. So there's, you know, it's nothing illegal about it, but it does seem a little unseemly. We need to get back to the normal way of doing things. Because of the rush to get these vaccines, we're listening to what the companies are saying. Doesn't mean the vaccines are bad, but it's not the traditional way we go about learning about the efficacy of vaccines.
MSNBC's Ali Velshi. This week, President-elect Joe Biden introduced his proposed national security team, led by Tony Blinken for Secretary of State. Blinken was part of the Obama administration and said he failed in not intervening sooner in Syria to prevent a horrific loss of life there. Years ago, Biden's choice for national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, conducted secret talks that led to the Iran nuclear deal. Biden said that his group, men and women, sends a clear signal to the world.
America is back. Ready to lead the world, not retreat from it. Once again, sit at the head of the table.
Well, that metaphor is apt on this Thanksgiving Day as those who can gather round tables. But it also represents a hairpin turn from President Trump's America First policy. We want to take a closer look with Jim Walsh, Here and Now security analyst with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
We will try. But, you know, I'm thinking it's hard to talk about foreign policy and security because it's usually so standard. We look at it through a filter of hawks and doves or interventionists and isolationists. Now, Trump supporters say the U.S. was doing too much globally, paying too much attention, paying too much money into NATO, for instance. And they agree with what was his pullback from global affairs. How would you characterize the Trump administration?
No, I think that's a really important point. The president has been disruptive in many ways, and he is neither a hawk nor or a dove. He both talks a tough line, fire and fury, threatening other countries, but also very reluctant to get involved in land wars or adventures abroad, particularly in the Middle East, willing to use military strikes, you know, from the air, but not boots on the ground. So I think it was really a mix of different things that scrambled all the traditional categories. I think we're headed back to a more traditional foreign and military policy. But he's not going away, and his impact won't go away in how people talk and think about these things.
And I want to talk about where you think we are going, but just staying with this scrambling, that's what I was kind of alluding to. And you mentioned the attacks. He ordered the attack that killed Iran's top military commander earlier this year, ordered other strikes against Iranian-backed groups in Iraq and Syria in 2019. Should he get credit for counterterrorism efforts?
If you're president for 4 years, you better have done something right over the course of all that time. And I think he can point to some successes. I would say, number one, he did not participate or initiate a major land war. We didn't have our war in Iraq or our war in Vietnam. Now, we used military force, sort of hit there, but we didn't actually fight a big war. And, you know, that's a good thing. Israel and the United Arab Emirates established relations. Maybe he spurred NATO to make bigger contributions. We didn't have a North Korean nuclear test for over a year. So, you know, there are definitely things on the positive side. I think the debit side outweighs, you know, because of the damage done to the U.S. national security process, among other losses. But there are definitely some things that he did. And you could say that his style meant that some countries, you know, tried to avoid getting on his wrong side or tried to accommodate him. You know, that's a kind of leverage if you use it properly. So I'd say it's a mixed record, mostly negative, but there are definitely some wins there for him.
What about our allies? It just feels as if this is a president, much as, you know, much as the country isn't hearing from him in recent months about a pandemic, it feels as if there wasn't communication with the world, with our allies.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you were talking about the negative side, certainly our relationship among our allies would be at the top of that, because he has sowed doubts among our allies in what we will do in the future. And he sort of diminished America's reputation abroad. You remember, I still remember people laughing at his speech at the UN. And, you know, that would have been a shocking thing. Or trying to enlist a foreign government to help in his election campaign. These are all things that definitely had strong negative impacts and have to be weighed on the ledger as well. But certainly, I think President-elect Biden, when he assumes office, one of the first priorities will be to signal symbolically, if not substantively, to our NATO allies, to South Korea and Japan, that they hope to restore that relationship. Now, can you go back? Can you ever go back home again to that pre-Trump time? I don't know, but that's what he's going to try to do.
But you said how much Trump has damaged our national security apparatus. What did you mean by that? I mean, I'm thinking of sort of refusing to say a negative word about Vladimir Putin, even though all our intelligence points to Russia's interference in elections, calling North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, you know, a friend, when there was no progress toward denuclearization.
Yeah, you know, I'm really talking about a different set of things. The president went through four secretaries of defense in 4 years. We went through two secretaries of state and several directors of national intelligence, several chiefs of staff, and several national security advisors. You can't run a business where the top management is being fired every year. So I think when I'm talking about the national security process, I mean the men and women, Republicans, Democrats, who serve every day, often in nonpartisan positions, and are trying to manage all the bad things that are going on in the world. And when you go in and you're a whirlwind and just sort of destroy things and leave it in a shambles, that leaves you vulnerable. So that's what bothers me. I'm pretty sure Biden will go back to the, you know, a system that is more traditional. And he may pursue the wrong ideas, he may pursue the right ideas, but at least the process will be a steady one that will help reduce risk.
Are you worried about what's being called vaccine nationalism, you know, the U.S. going it alone on vaccine development, planning to distribute domestically, while the EU, other wealthy democracies are buying up some of our stock, but also joining with the WHO plan to distribute to poorer countries because China and Russia, they're pushing their own, not even completely tested vaccines to these poorer countries. And some, like I'm reading David Fidler of the Council of Foreign Relations, says, you know, the U.S. isn't just not in the game, but this pandemic becomes a force multiplier because it's accelerating the weakening of U.S. influence.
I think it's a concern, but I think the U.S. is going to do the right thing here, if only because it's obvious. I mean, if you have Russia and China putting out untested vaccines in order to get some sort of PR edge, then boy, that sure sounds like something that can blow up on you and not go very well. If the U.S. does what is traditionally done and been an international humanitarian leader, so that we say we're going to produce as much vaccine as we can and we're going to share it with everyone because this is a global problem, not a national problem, and we only beat it together. If we do that, we will undo all the negative anger that has been built up over many years, and we will once again be perceived as the country we ought to be perceived as, which is, you know, both a leader in technology and science, but in humanitarian affairs. If we do that, that will be a winner. And I bet we do that.
We've been talking internationally, but just quickly, closer to home. Over the last couple of years, we've seen the rise of white supremacist militia groups. And we know that our agencies think that they are the number one domestic terror and problem. Your sense of what happens now?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly, you rightly point to FBI numbers, which are undeniable, that the shift in the terror threat in the United States has really moved from foreign to domestic and from, you know, religious base to nationalism and white supremacy. And it's a question that points to a larger thing in our conversation about foreign policy. We can talk about this issue or that issue, but the truth is, if the world permits it, the Biden presidency is going to be a domestic presidency because we have COVID. Then we've got the economic impact of that. And he's got midterms, you know, right around the corner. So I think this guy, other than maybe climate, is really going to be focusing at home. And foreign policy will likely take on more of a managerial feel, you know, keeping things stable, no surprises, nothing blowing up, and freeing him to focus like a laser on COVID and the economy. That's what I expect to happen. And certainly one of the domestic aspects of that will be terrorism and law enforcement going forward. How do we organize ICE? How do we organize Homeland Security? Of course, he just appointed a new person. Those will all be thickets of debates, and the Republicans in the Senate and elsewhere will be watching every move he makes.
Jim Walsh, you're now security analyst from MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thank you, and we are thankful for you on this day. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks very much.
For centuries, composers have drawn inspiration from the oldest melody makers in the world, birds. For example, this piece is called Summer Has Arrived. It's from the mid-1200s, and it features musical references to the cuckoo bird, a species that would continue to inspire Handel, Beethoven, and Mahler hundreds of years later. Nashville Public Radio's Kara McLellan brought us this history last year. Sharing it again is our Thanksgiving gift to you.
That's a swan. Well, more specifically, that's Kristen Englands imitating a swan. Englands lives in Nashville and is a musician. She also knows a thing or two about birds and birdsong.
I am the 2009 International Bird Call Imitation Champion.
So I asked her why she thinks so many composers have been drawn to the cuckoo.
The cuckoo actually is kind of indicative of spring for a lot of Europeans, but it's such an iconic sound, and kind of like the loon, it's approachable. It's two notes for the most part, and, you know, it kind of gets stuck in your head.
As it turns out, imitating complex birdsong is really hard. That might be another reason that so many composers have stuck with the simple, two-note motive of the cuckoo. Other composers have taken a different route, and instead of trying to match a bird note for note, they try to capture the essence of the bird through music. Like Vivaldi's Goldfinch Concerto. In 1729, it was one of the first concertos to feature a flute solo performing bird-like warbles and trills. There may be a reason for this. The goldfinch is tricky to imitate.
They'll just pick up other birds' songs and adapt them into their own and learn different patterns throughout their entire life.
Thanks to Vivaldi, the flute is often used to imitate birds. Some composers don't even try to capture how a bird sounds, but instead focus on how it looks and how it moves. That's the case with Camille Saint-Saëns' take on the swan from his suite, The Carnival of the Animals. The elegant cello line perfectly captures a swan gliding through a serene lake and the arching curve of its neck. England says that artists have also romanticized the swan because it's a monogamous bird. It picks a mate and sticks with it for life. But through those artistic representations, the swan may have earned a graceful reputation that it might not deserve.
Their temperament is just nasty. If you see a swan, likely you'll have someone telling you to stay away from the swan.
In 1924, Italian composer Ottorino Respighi did something revolutionary. He wrote one of the first pieces of music to blend electronics with a live orchestra by using a phonograph on the concert stage. At the end of the third movement of The Pines of Rome, Respighi played a recording of a bird that he had actually heard among the Roman trees, a nightingale. Like the cuckoo, the nightingale has popped up again and again as a source of inspiration for classical composers.
I think night can be a really lonely time. Just to have something singing in the darkness is pretty profound.
But the composer who probably loved birdsong more than anyone else was Olivier Messiaen. The 20th century French composer spent decades of his career filling thousands of pages with transcribed bird songs he collected to put into his music.
Et voici le rossignol. Il éclate tout d'un coup brusquement.
This is Messiaen talking about the nightingale and the two distinct sections of its song. The percussive opener. And what he describes as a lower harpsichord gong timbre. Messiaen wrote some of the most innovative and challenging music of the 20th century, and that holds true for his bird-inspired work. But knowing that the music was inspired by birds makes it that much more familiar and approachable. And that's why Kristen Englands thinks that composers have been so captivated by birdsong all these years, because they truly are the masters of connecting and communicating through music.
Whether they're calling out to a mate or sending a warning or saying, hey, there's some food here, or, you know, communicating to their young, they do it all in pitches and music in a way. And I think that's just fascinating, and it's kind of like an ideal way of being for musicians.
Or, in the words of Olivier Messiaen, birds are first and foremost the greatest performers. For Here and Now, I'm Kara McLeland.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. Happy Thanksgiving from all of us at Here and Now.